the electorate and voting behaviour. In this lecture, we're going to be looking mostly at the makeup of Parliament, the franchise, and how people voted in the early 18th century. The type of people who were MPs changed after the Glorious Revolution. The revolutionary settlement restricted membership to those who had what was termed a permanent fixed interest in the realm. In the main, this meant people who owned land independently. MPs were drawn from a very narrow social range, which spanned at most only 0.5% of the total population. And a Property Qualifications Act of 1711 further restricted membership of Parliament to those possessing land worth over £600 per annum for county members and £300 for borough members. The size of Parliament was similar to that of today. In England and Wales, there were 513 MPs who represented between them 314 constituencies. And for Scotland, there were 45 MPs representing 45 constituencies. Turning to the franchise then, there are two types of constituencies in this period, the counties and boroughs. We'll turn first to the county franchise. This was a uniform franchise based on an Act of 1430, enabling 40 shilling freeholders to own the vote. This included people like tenants who had leases for lives and those who had rents and mortgages based on freehold property. Also those who had occupations which bestowed tenure, in particular members of universities and ecclesiastical positions. Counties then were usually quite large constituencies and were rarely under the control of a single family or aristocrat. Crucially, there was no residence qualification, so anybody owning property in the county could vote, and outvoters could perform a deciding role in very close elections. The largest county constituency was Yorkshire, which had around 10,000 voters, and the smallest counties were Carnarvonshire in Wales and Rutland, which had about 500 voters. To complicate things further, there are also a number of towns which had county status, including Lincoln, Hull and York. So these constituencies also had 40 shilling freehold franchises. The borough franchise was far more complicated. There were several different types of boroughs, and I'll briefly go through these and their different characteristics. The first is the so-called inhabitant boroughs. There were 55 of these, and basically here all residents were able to vote, although the definition of who was a resident could differ. So for example, in Preston, just overnight residence before an election qualified somebody to vote. But they also included those who paid poor rates, or all householders, the so-called pot walloper boroughs, anybody who boiled a pot on a hearth. The constituencies could be open and large, but they could also include so-called rotten boroughs if the population had diminished to a tiny size. The second group are the so-called burgage boroughs. There are 41 of these. Burgages are ancient pieces of real estate and property from which the right to vote was derived. This could be a house, but it could also be a field barn or outbuilding. In some places, those who were occupying the burgage plot could vote, whilst in others, the person who owned the burgage plot exercised the right to vote and could put in his or her nominee. Examples of burgage boroughs include Ripon and Reigate. A third category are the corporation boroughs, and there are 19 of these. Here the right to vote was restricted to members of the corporation. Typically these were the mayor, aldermen and common councilmen, and therefore a very restricted franchise. Examples include Winchester and Bury St Edmunds. Therefore, most corporation boroughs were venal and corrupt. A fourth category is the so-called freeman boroughs. This is where only freemen were able to vote. Freedom was gained by inheritance, by purchase, or by apprenticeship, and examples included Bristol, Nottingham, Leicester, and Liverpool. The largest freeman boroughs had thousands of voters, but the smallest could again be easily controlled. If a patron controlled a corporation, he could also control the number of freemen that were admitted to the borough and thus were able to vote. Similarly, a large number of so-called honorary freemen could be created just before an election. The fifth category is that of university borough. The university towns of Oxford and Cambridge also had the franchise. Here the vote was restricted to doctors and masters of arts of the two universities. In each case, around 300 voted, but the number entitled to do so was obviously higher. Cambridge had a Whig tradition and Oxford a Tory one. Turning to Wales and Scotland then, in Wales there were 12 one-member counties and 12 one-member boroughs, which totaled 24 seats in all. The county franchise followed the English pattern of the 40-shilling freehold, and in the boroughs there were corporation boroughs, freeman boroughs and two inhabitant boroughs, with electorates ranging from 80 to 2,000. Welsh counties tended to have a small electorate and were often likely to fall under the control of a single patron, but most boroughs were comparatively open, although they did have fewer contests than England. Scotland joined the English system after the Act of Union. In Scotland there were 31 member counties and 15 so-called districts of boroughs, which returned one MP each, thus totalling 45 seats in all. Scottish boroughs were very venal, employing a method of indirect election. In counties, the Scottish electoral qualification was based upon something called the old extent, that is, on land worth either £70 or £130 per annum. Elections were usually fought on a straight party ticket. In two-member constituencies, voters had two votes apiece, and therefore could vote either wholly along a party ticket for two Whig candidates, or they could plump for one candidate and so-called waste one of their votes. Each party had election managers who organised the party's fortunes in the country, so there was some level of party organisation. The electorate also grew steadily throughout the 18th century. Totals are hard to calculate because there are no electoral registers until 1832. The growth was achieved by a number of methods, by widening of the franchise by Parliament in certain constituencies, by an increase in population, by a drop in the actual value of a 40-shilling freehold, and the creation of votes splitting burgage plots or creating honorary freemen, for example. Plum estimates that there were around 200,000 voters in William's reign, and this had risen to about 250,000 in 1715. Holmes, on the other hand, calculates that there were over 340,000 voters, around one in four of the adult male population, who could vote by 1722. In this early period, voters were also more evenly distributed across the country than later in the century, and the Triennial Act of 1694 ensured that there were many contests in which they could exercise their vote. Turning to voting behaviour, Speck has argued that only the Anglican clergy and the dissenters were reliable voters at this period. All other voters, he argues, were highly influenced by ideology and the ideology and policy of the parties. He says there were substantial numbers of floating voters and that voters changed their minds frequently. He plays down the role of bribery and corruption in elections. Holmes support this view, saying that the electorate control the political fortunes of the governing classes and that at times they held the fate of succession in their hands. These rather optimistic views of the electorate have been challenged, most notably by Namier, who argued the freeholders were a dependent class, and J.C.D. Clarke, who has argued that no democratic tendencies existed in this period. Other historians, such as Landau and Baskerville, have noticed certain levels of deference where whole parishes or townships voted in accordance with a resident patron or large landowner, perhaps because of careful management, but also perhaps because of bribery and corruption. It's clear that there's no simple single explanation of voting behaviour and of voter independence in this period. The electorates, as we've seen, are far too dissimilar across the borough and county divide. What was true for one borough will not be true for another. Voting was primarily on local issues in this period, although certain national issues, such as the Dr. Sacheverell affair, could cut across these local interests. So ultimately, the historian has to rely on detailed research on a constituency by constituency level to try and discern a general pattern of voting behaviour and the independence of the electorate in this period.